Stan, it's always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Greg. Great to be with you.
Well, the concern over communists within our government predated World War II, but really took on significance, of course, once the Cold War set in following the war. One of the things you discuss in the book that's very interesting is how Harry Truman, who history grants strong Cold Warrior credentials for the Berlin Airlift, Marshall Plan, aid to Greece and Turkey, among other things, wanted little or nothing to do with exposing communists within his own administration. He even defended Alger Hiss after Hiss was sentenced to prison. What was it about our leadership at the time that did not want to believe that this was a real threat?
Well, it's a very good question. I'm not sure I know the answer, but you certainly summarized it well. There's no question that Harry Truman was a visceral anti-communist, and I say that in the book, but he had a blind side to him about communists within his own government. He just didn't believe it. He wouldn't believe it. He had people around him who were very bad influences who told him it wasn't true. It was also a partisan issue, and the Republicans were hammering him on this, and they were being partisan. But he was a feisty partisan himself, and to admit all this would be to help the Republicans and would have been very damaging to his party. So it was some mix of all those motives that caused him to have this blind side toward people like Alger Hiss and the problem in general.
And, of course, Joe McCarthy came to the forefront, probably most especially because of a speech he gave in Wheeling, West Virginia, in which he, of course, said that he had a list of communists in his hand that were already working in the United States government. What did that do in terms of setting up the opposition to Joe McCarthy? You point out in the book that the speech itself has actually been incorrectly chronicled by history.
Correct. Well, first of all, your sequencing of these questions is very, very good because there's a direct linkage between what we were talking about in the case of Truman and then the McCarthy thing. Under Truman, it had all been kind of bottled up, and Congress, there was a secrecy order that prevented Congress from getting the files on these cases from the State Department, from the FBI. And the Congress knew there was a problem, but it was all kind of under the rug or shoved in the closet. And there was a lot of discontent in Congress about this. And when Joe McCarthy came along 2 years later after the Hiss case, he touched off an explosion that had been years in the making, not only because of the infiltration, which was a very serious problem, but because it had been denied and covered up. And so that's what caused this enormous eruption of fury back in 1950, because stuff that had been going on for years had been denied, and now he was saying the denial was false. What happened in the speech at Wheeling, I devote a chapter to that, as I can tell you know because of the way you asked your question. And it was a question of the number he used. Did he say 205 communists or did he say 57? His critics say he said 205, and they contended this over and over again. It's in all the history books. This became the subject of an investigation in the Senate in 1951. They sent investigators up to Wheeling to find out what the facts were. I mean, they're devoting all their time to this issue of this number. The investigators come back and tell their Senate bosses, well, basically, McCarthy is right. He didn't say 205. He said 57. That report then disappeared and was never mentioned again because it didn't prove what they wanted to prove, which was that Joe McCarthy had perjured himself. So that's in a nutshell what happened in that particular episode up at Wheeling, West Virginia.
And then, of course, Stan, throughout the book, as I mentioned, 6 years of research on your part, you go painstakingly case by case and contrast what the facts were with what conventional wisdom tells us about these things. I want to go back to a point you just made, though, about the damage being done by communists in the government due largely to the fact that many wanted to turn a blind eye. Just go over a couple of those things that happened as a result of those not wanting to believe that communists were, in fact, within the government ranks.
Well, let me give you just one. It was probably McCarthy's number one case, really. It was a case of a man named John Stuart Service, who was an American diplomat living in Chongqing, China. He was a big China expert back in the 1940s. He was living in a house in Chongqing, China, with not one but two Soviet agents, as we now know from the information we have. One of them was a Treasury Department attaché in China named Solomon Adler. The other was an ethnic Chinese named Chi Chao-ting. Both of these people were Soviet agents. Both of them, one of them, Chi Chao-ting, was infiltrating the government, the then anti-communist government of Chiang Kai-shek in China. When China fell to the communists, both Adler and Chi Chao-ting went to live in Beijing and lived out their lives as employees of the Red Chinese government. That's how obvious agents they were. John Stewart Service is living with these guys. He and Adler combined in sending back communiques to the American government saying that Chiang Kai-shek, the anti-communist, is evil, corrupt, he's not really fighting the Japanese, and that the Chinese communists are heroes.
Stan, let's talk about perhaps the most famous encounter that Joe McCarthy had during this effort to expose communism within the government, and that, of course, is the Army-McCarthy hearings in 1954. You point out in the book that the most famous exchange, perhaps, in the whole episode between McCarthy and Joseph Welch, yep, the special counsel for the Army, was really been taken out of context and was really more of a smokescreen than someone who really felt victimized by the interrogation.
Yeah, I would go further. It was a completely phony act on the part of Joe Welch. What happened was, it's kind of complicated. Welch had been baiting Roy Cohn, who was McCarthy's principal aide, in questioning Cohn about information he had about communists in the government. And he went on and on and on at great length, Welch did, but why Cohn did not instantly hand this information over to the Secretary of the Army, and this went on for a long time, and baiting him on that issue. It so happened that Welch had had an assistant named Frederick Fisher, who had been a member of the National Lawyers Guild, and had been sent back to home to Boston, where the law firm was, because of this. After McCarthy listened enough to this questioning of Cohn about this, he interrupts saying, "Well, Mr. Welch, if you want to know about subversives and you want to know about them right away, I should note that you have this guy Frederick Fisher that you brought down here to work in these hearings." Well, at this point, Welch just he bursts into tears at the end of it. He denounces McCarthy for character assassination, for having exposed this innocent young man as being a member of the National Lawyers Guild, on and on and on. And this is all in the, you'll see video clips of this over and over again of Welch going through this routine. "Have you no decency, sir?" and so on. Well, this is all totally phony. And in fact, as I point out in the chapter, Frederick Fisher, Welch's assistant, had already been outed as a member of the National Lawyers Guild 6 weeks before this by Joseph Welch himself. And I reprint in the book the actual article from the New York Times in the middle of April 54, this hearing is in June, in which Welch says, we're sending Fred Fisher back to Boston because of he was a member of the National Lawyers Guild. So this is printed in the New York Times, and they say the National Lawyers Guild was a cited communist front by the Attorney General. And they run a great big picture of Frederick Fisher with the article, which Joe McCarthy at least didn't show a picture of Fred Fisher. So the whole thing that Welch was denouncing McCarthy for, he had already done himself 6 weeks before. That's why I say it was a phony act.
Couple minutes left in our conversation with M. Stanton Evans. The book is Blacklisted by History, The Untold Story of Senator Joe McCarthy and His Fight Against America's Enemies. From that point, given public sentiment and the way that the story was told in the mainstream media following the Army-McCarthy hearings, the tide of public opinion turned against Joe McCarthy. But you point out that his censure by the Senate was not as drastic as a lot of people think it is. In fact, they really only ran him up on one count against him, despite the dozens that were originally filed.
That's correct. What happened was, and referring back to our discussion a couple of minutes ago about the Wheeling speech, the investigators who went to Wheeling came back with a report saying McCarthy was right and that he didn't use the 205. Remember that conversation? Those investigators were sent up there by a committee called the Subcommittee on Privileges and Elections. And when the investigators came back with a report that McCarthy was right and that the charges were wrong, that report then disappears. The committee then launched an intensive investigation of McCarthy's personal finances dating back to 1935, which was over a decade before he ever was elected to the Senate. It had nothing to do with the Senate election. They looked in the finances of his father, of his brother, his brother-in-law, on a long list of people, delving and running barefoot through his financial records, trying to develop personal information against him. This is the committee, and they did other things, but those are the main ones. This is the committee that he was allegedly in defiance of because he wouldn't cooperate with them. And that was the one count, the failure to cooperate with that committee, that was originally presented among 46 counts against him, for which he was censured by the Senate. For defying that committee, he was censured for that.
Last question, Stan, and it's a two-parter. You mentioned that a lot of the research you have done recently is a result of certain documents becoming available that hadn't been available prior to that. How different do you think history would be if some of these documents that you've had access to had been available for the past half century? And secondly, what is the impact, in your opinion, of history apparently getting this wrong for the past half century?
Well, the first thing is that, obviously, if people had known a lot of this background back then, history would, I would think, could have been very different. If we'd known for a fact that John Stewart Service was living with two Soviet agents in Chungking, that probably would have affected our view of that case, and there was more to that one. Or if we'd known a bunch of other people that were pretending to be conscientious liberals were, in fact, had been communists, like the editor of the New Republic, Michael Strait, who had been recruited into the Communist Party at Cambridge in the 1930s, and it was really sent back here as a Soviet agent, and then became the editor of the New Republic, in which he's denouncing McCarthy. It would have been kind of interesting to know those facts at that time. So that would have been a big difference. I think that the other thing I would say about that, and going in an opposite direction, we still don't know everything we need to know. There's still a lot of stuff that's secret. I'm still trying to get stuff under freedom of information. There are crucial documents in McCarthy cases that are withheld, pulled out of the archives, and I'm trying to get some of those now. But we sure know a lot more than we did, and what it tells us bring it all back around, as McCarthy had the big picture right, and the government was indeed heavily infiltrated with these people. He had the cover-up right, that it was being covered up, it was being denied. He said that over and over again. And if you look at the specific cases I try to do in my book, you see over and over again those same cases popping up in the FBI records and in the records of the State Department, and which is essentially where McCarthy got them.